3, 2, 1, see ya.
You're listening to the Beast Life Podcast with your hosts, Randy and Brian.
All right, gentlemen, welcome to the Base Life Podcast. It's been a little while, but yeah, trying to get it back on track and be. I'm not gonna stick to a schedule, but I just want to be more deliberate about recordings and doing it whenever. Whenever I can. But you know, when there's something, it feels like there's something important to talk about. You know.
Yeah, it's cool. I know we talked about this last summer and stuff, so it's good to finally get it done.
Yeah, man. I've been really looking forward to sitting down with you. And then, Cyril, I didn't even know you were in town, but it just seemed like perfect when I found out. I was like, yeah, if you can join us.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
So here we have Devin Kelly and Cyril Sigon.
Yeah, sorry, Sigal.
Yeah, Sigal. Sorry. So like I said, I'm terrible with last names because we don't really use them a lot. And then half the people don't even use Facebook, like, with the real name. So I'm like, what's your actual name? What do I call you? But, I wanted to sit down and talk about snag hazards and, like, certain jump considerations, partially in light of, you know, what happened with Jono, a little over a month ago. And then also just I've seen a few trends online that I don't know if it's indicative of something larger or if it's just like what I'm pinging on, but felt like it'd be something good to talk about. And then maybe some how we mitigate risk and layer when we're layering variables to jumps, the variables that individually not such a big deal, but when they're on top of each other, then it becomes a big deal. So
right. As with pretty much every incident report, we usually see that it wasn't one variable that led to the incident. It was either a sequence of them or a few combined.
Yeah, just in conjunction with each other, right?
Right. I know we already mentioned Jono going in. It was about 2 months ago, and I know we were able to recover the camera at the bottom of the nose and reviewed the footage, and that gave us a good timeline of events, what happened, what went right, what went wrong, and then between the few of us that reviewed it, we were able to write a pretty detailed report.
Yeah. Yeah, do you want to just go through some of the, I guess, you don't have to go minute by minute, but like what happened with that incident, and then you know what he did right, maybe what he did wrong, and still feel free to chime in because we've all experienced or been near situations similar to this. So
yeah, sure. Well, there was one, I suppose, primary thing that led to all the other issues. Or rather, there was one variable that was the worst of them, which was that he had one of those unicorn mounts, which we often jokingly refer to as death sticks. Well, it's true, they have led to many deaths, you know. And in this instance with Jono, he had one of those unicorn mounts with a 360 camera. What ended up happening is when he opened and had a 180, he's facing the wall. He reached up with both hands. Right hand grabs a rear riser, left hand grabs the front. I'm sure he was mistaken. That I'm sure he thought they were both on rear risers because of his proximity to the wall and just that general situation. You don't want to be on a front riser in that situation. However, he was. So with his left hand, he cranks on the front riser, which causes him to have his first cliff strike. And after the first impact, he kind of doubles down on that front left. Again, probably, I'm sure he was thinking that it was a rear. we all of us in this community knew him to be a very competent and cautious and educated jumper. So I'm sure that he knew the correct procedure, but you never really know how you're going to react in that situation until you're facing the cliff. So he had the front riser, doubles down on it, and when he impacts the second time, lets it go. And the dive loops that some base canopies have these days on the front risers, like for swooping or pulling the front riser, that dive loop got stuck on the lower screw of his GoPro mount. So he pretty much, and then under all that tension, it pretty much stuck there for the duration of his fall, and until eventually the camera bracket broke. And so basically he had full left front riser input through the entire sequence of his impacts, and while he's trying to deal with turning his canopy away from the cliff, that dive loop got stuck on the lower GoPro peg, and it was just kind of like a freak, or just shit luck, you know. But it happened. It got stuck. It was snagged under a lot of tension, and there was no way it was gonna kind of come off on its own. So yeah, those death sticks, GoPros in general. Another variable that could have also kind of combined with this was an aerial. He had done a gainer on this jump, and
At nose three, which has a big three. Protruding thing, like wall sort of sticking out on the left.
Right. Yeah. Now, the gainer went fine. This and that. I don't want to go too in-depth about his own jump and everything, but I just know a lot of people, we've talked about this in the base community a lot when doing aerials. GoPro, sometimes it's best to leave the GoPro at home. Or because of the snag hazards. Some people replace those GoPro pegs, those screws, with like just a regular bolt that you get at a hardware store. That at least mitigates the snag hazard a little bit. Of course, you still have the camera. I know in skydiving, it's pretty popular to use, there are like customized GoPro mounts that are less of a snag hazard. Also a good thing to look into. And I suppose given the popularity of 360 cameras these days and the way they work, I think a lot of us are tempted to start jumping with those unicorn mounts for that 360 footy. And but it's definitely worth having a think about that, given the huge snag hazard that it can be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and especially like what kind of jump you're going to do and where, especially if you're using like a 360, because cool footage, don't get me wrong. I love watching it. I love how you can watch someone's exit and then they kind of like turn it around and then you see them like leaving and then they turn it back around when they're like flying near stuff, but which yeah. I also don't strongly condone. But I mean, make your own, it's your jump, whatever. I just have a lot of dead friends that used to fly close to stuff. So like with 360 in particular, like I've seen some other footage where guys were jumping off a bridge and like they were, one guy was behind the other one and they were sort of holding hands and they did this little flip, like he dove over him and then it just went to shit real fast. Like
I might have seen this footage.
Yeah, and you know, no names to be. You know, we've all done silly shit, so you know, it is what it is. And thankfully, nobody had a bad day, but they were definitely wearing 360s with unicorns. And when you do those rotations, and then when you start swimming, and things get a little bit out of control, it's like, well, you're already on the ride. Now you just gotta hopefully figure it out. But if you think about those things in advance. You know, maybe put that thing on your chest or something, or not sticking out from your head, especially if you're going to pitch low or, you know, off kilter or upside down or, you know. But yeah, one other thing, because Jono, typically we, at least I sort of knew him as like either a one-piece tracker or maybe a wingsuiter, like sort of doing that kind of flying. And typically, I think if you're belly to earth and moving forward, you know, the 360 mounts, I think a lot of the risk is mitigated with just the direction you're flying. But when you add that flip in there, and you add that he was wearing a Pikachu, like, I don't know, like onesie, pajama type thing, all of that in conjunction with being at nose three where they have that bit that sticks out on the left, like just all those layers just added together, you know, led to something bad. And any one of those things could have been taken out, and maybe he wouldn't have had such a bad day. Maybe. You never know. But Cyril and I, just last night, in fact, you know, we started talking. I was like, oh, yeah, you're in town. Let's do a jump. You know, I got some friends here. I want them to see what we do. And and then, like, because I haven't been super active in jumping. I'm back on a two-piece tracksuit. And the ramp's up, and it's really tempting to go to the ramp because it's easy to get there. Yeah. You know, we had a timeline this morning to get my friends off to go do some other cool Swiss stuff, and it just made sense, you know, with everything to do the ramp. And then we're like, oh, well, maybe we do a two-way. And then I'm thinking, and none of it is hitting me. But thankfully, my wife was, you know, with us at dinner, and later on she's like, are you sure you want to do that? Because, you know, the ramp deserves respect, and you're not super current. And when's the last time you did a two-way? And she's so gentle about how she, like,
yeah,
like does those little course corrections for me sometimes. But, yeah, I went to bed thinking everything was going to be fine, and then I woke up at about 2 with just this, like, feeling in my stomach, like, this might not be a good idea, bro. Like, you, like, you know, you have to respect the mountain, and there are certain places that you can go and do certain things when maybe you're not as current, but just because I've been coming here for a decade doesn't exempt me from having a bad day. And those were two clear, or at least clear to my wife, variables that I was willing to introduce that I hadn't, like, hadn't done in a while. And so, yeah, we ended up calling the jump off because I don't know if I'm getting altitude sickness or something, like, because I haven't been here much. But yeah, things weren't going well in the stomach today. And I was like, today's not one of those days. Like,
yeah, and sometimes that happens, and then you just say, no, I'm going to walk down today.
Yeah,
no problem with that.
And being motivated to jump because my friends were here and I wanted them to see it, I feel like that was also not a good motivating factor because – you know, I jump for me. I don't jump for anyone else. And that this was one of those times I was like, I mean, they got to see other people jump. Like, they didn't. So they got the experience. And I think they were feeling some anxiety because they don't want to see something happen to me. You know, and this is completely a foreign concept for them. So
I think that would have been how do you say? A lot of stress is added. The fact that you haven't jumped the ramp for a long time, the fact that your friends were there watching you, and that we were planning to do a two-way, that's like three things, pretty stressful situation. I definitely understand it, yeah.
Yeah.
It's important, too, to remember that the ramp is high altitude. Even with the ramp, it's not like a... I mean, yeah, it's not a beginner jump by any means. Obviously not a beginner jump, but it's also one that you really need to be heads up on. It led to a few fatalities this summer, and that's been true since High Ultimate's been opened, really, in the valley.
Oh, we had one year, the day the ramp went up, a guy went in because he went wingsuiting and he went head low and then ended up on his back and flew into the wall. Like the day the ramp went up. So it's one of those things where you gotta be ready. Gotta be on it. And, and I've never been exactly known as a great tracker. I've jumped with a lot of great trackers. They've tried to make me better. But I have hit and miss days, and, Ultimate's not somewhere you want to have a miss day, you know?
Right.
But yeah, it's.
Randy, you said you mentioned the factor about having your friends in town, and you kind of felt like this sort of like added pressure to, you know, show your friends a jump, things like that. And I think that's also a topic worth acknowledging in this sport. I've had two accidents in base. I mean, I've had some bad jumps and stuff like that, but I have two real incidents where things obviously went wrong. The second one was last summer when I broke my leg, which we could talk about later if you want. But the first was a few years ago. I was wingsuiting here in the valley off Dumpster. I had just met my now wife, Peggy, and she came up to Dumpster with me and a few friends to photograph us. She's a brilliant photographer. And also my mother's birthday was coming up. So I went into that jump like, oh, I'm going to get this sick shot from Peggy for my mom for her birthday. So I'm going to have like this badass exit. You know, I'm like fucking just give it all the power I have and stuff. And I stupidly, in retrospect, it was obviously stupid, but I stepped in snow with my wingsuit on, with my booty. I couldn't get over to the dry rock because of the leg wing, and I stepped in snow and then got on the dry rock. So basically that caused me, that coupled with this like power exit that I was doing to nail the shot, caused me to slip, scorpion and flip over, and ended up impacting the cliff a few times. And like that incident, to put it shortly, basically I was super lucky, was able to basically walk away from it pretty banged up, but like no broken bones. But the point being that I have to acknowledge, if I'm being honest with myself, that I did feel this added sort of pressure. You could call it like ego, something like that, where I wanted to nail the shot for my mom. And I mean, I had just met my now wife, Peggy, and you know, I probably obviously wanted to show off a little bit for her.
Yeah.
Of course,
it's
it was
natural.
One of the most embarrassing jumps I've ever done.
Yeah.
Instead, but
yeah,
it is important to acknowledge that in base, I think.
Yeah, and it takes a certain level of maturity maybe to even recognize that. And, you know, and even looking at Jono's incident, I'm not sure, even if I was with him, I'm not sure I would have put it all together and been like, oh, are you sure you want to do this? Like, it's really hard to say. So like, I cast no blame. I mean, we all do our own jumps. We all take our own risks. It is what it is. But the, so... You know, circling back to my friends, like they were actually relieved that I wasn't gonna jump, because I could definitely feel it giving them a little bit of anxiety and stuff. So it was, you know, letting other people risk their lives and have fun and get it, let them seeing that was enough, you know. So it was, yeah. But
actually, Cyril, do you remember we went up to Oxel one time, and with a group of us, like five of us, wingsuiting, and that was a tricky one because it is a technical jump with a pretty flat part in between. The exit is positive. It's not the tallest exit in the world either. Mm-hmm. And we all sat down. We all analyzed the exit, the flight plan, sat down and had our own individual think about the jump, whether we wanted to do it or not. And if you guys said like, no, I'll just walk down, a couple others jumped and stuff. And but I think that kind of speaks to a level of maturity in the sport, and also as a person, to be able to go there with a group of guys, put egos aside, analyze a jump for any variables that could make it dangerous, and decide whether or not that's within your individual ability level or if it's the jump that you want to be doing at that moment. It's really important to be able to walk down from jumps, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I think on that day, when I first looked at the jump from the bottom, I was thinking, oh, this is really cool. This is gonna be such an awesome jump. And all of you guys were like really looking confident to me. But when I looked down, I thought, okay, this is actually looks a little bit more technical than what I'm used to. And it wasn't easy at the beginning, thinking, okay, should I go or not? And then after like maybe 5 minutes, I was thinking, okay, I'm asking myself the question too many times. I'm not going to enjoy the jump as much as I can, just because I have all these question about will I make it over the first ledge, let's say. I don't know if we can call it a ledge on this place. I wasn't sure if I could clear it with the wingsuit that I had at that time, which was a little bit smaller than the suit that you guys were flying as well. But yeah, I had like too many questions that I couldn't answer, and I just, yeah, after like 5 or 10 minutes, I was like thinking, okay, this is it makes more sense to just walk down. The hike is actually really nice. I'm quite happy to be here, and I would just come back later without the stress. Now that I've been up there, looking at the exit, I know what the exit is like, what I need to do, how I need to perform to get the job the jump down. And I know I can come another time with all this information already in my head, without having the surprise of, okay, this is quite technical. Now I know what it is, and I'll wait for the right time to go there. Yeah,
the mountain's not going away, you know.
No, but living to jump another day is sometimes easier said than done, you know. It's good that you were able to recognize that. When you start asking yourself too many questions, you know, I call it dealing with probablys. Like, it'll probably be fine. Yeah, I like to reduce that as much as possible, you know, and because I want to be certain that things are good and everything's in place. So yeah, it's a.
Well, something that I've learned from my job is that under stress and pressure, you do perform not as good as you think you're doing. And that's looking back after thing that happened. You're thinking, oh, I have made this mistake and this mistake. But you realize that a little bit later, like a few days later sometimes. And you're thinking, like, how did I do these mistakes? Like, I never usually do them. Like, this is not, it feels like it wasn't yourself on that day. And just because there was a little bit more pressure, a little bit more stress. So now with the jumping, I try to implement that as well. If I think there is a little bit, too much stress about the jump, like jumping a new suit, jumping a new mount, whatever you're adding to something that you're not doing, that you're not usually doing. If it's a little bit too much, I'm thinking, okay, now I know that I won't be performing as good as I usually will do. So I either decide to jump by thinking about it, by thinking, okay, I'm under stress, so I'm probably not going to be as good, so I have to take more margins, so not flying as close to the ground, not putting too low, like putting higher than I usually do, and so on, or either not jumping at all and thinking, okay, I'll just do another easier jump that I know, or take off the new mount or whatever the new gear that I have on me, and or just move on and jump another day, you know. Yeah.
You know, I like that you mentioned how you guys talked about the jump and took some time to analyze everything, and then some people decided not to jump, which I feel like is a good segue for a link I'm going to put in the show notes. It's something Next Level put together called the five Minutes for Safety, and you can print it out online. It's a PDF, and it's basically like a little checklist of just things to consider or things to look at before you jump, and to make sure everything is in order. And so that's, I feel like that's something that, I mean, you could easily, the goal, like, because they were handing them out, you know, back when they made this thing, like nice little card stock, you know, like, so you could literally just put it in one of your pockets on your wingsuit, and then just go over it real quick. Because anyone familiar with, you know, the pilot industry, whether military or civilian, pilots all have a checklist, and I like to joke with some of my pilot friends. I'm like, well, yeah, a monkey can read a checklist, so flying can't be that hard. Even though I've spent like 20 years sitting in airplanes, you know, waiting to jump out, and I still don't know how to fly an airplane. So, I'll put something in the show notes for that, so that people can check it out and maybe add it to their kit. I'd also like to plug Lowe's podcast real quick, Exit Point. He and Matt Blank are doing a really great show. So if you're looking for something a little bit more consistent than me and oftentimes maybe a little bit more technical, there's a good reason for that, because they're way better base jumpers than I am. So I hold Matt and Lowe in very high regard, and so I'm stoked that they're you know, they're sharing their you know their base life with the rest of us. So
They're two guys who are super experienced, analytical, knowledgeable, and giving back to the base world. Yeah, Exit Point, the podcast, is super cool, informative. I was fortunate enough to jump with Matt Blank a couple years ago in Paris a bunch, and he's an awesome guy. So
and Lo and I did like 15 hours of tunnel in Munich together. We he's been on the podcast quite a few times. Gave him some tips when it came to getting their thing started. I'm just stoked to see more information. I feel like just more information is better, you know, for our community. Like, there, it's not a competition.
I think the sport is growing too. Just kind of based on my own subjective feeling about the quantity of people coming to Lauterbrunnen. Of course, it died down during the COVID years and stuff, but like, I know Dugs and Sam were busy all summer with a bunch of courses and other schools as well. I think the sport is growing, so the more knowledge we can kind of share as a community, the better, of course. And I know every year there are more and more new jumpers, and sometimes as a new jumper, you don't necessarily know who's learned what lessons or what techniques. And yeah, so I remember when I started base, I was hungry for any material I could get my hands on. Great Book of Base, a course, whatever, Bridge Day and this and that. But like podcasts and interviews with guys, and yeah, it's cool. It's really cool what you're doing too, Randy, with the podcast.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it's funny because schools weren't really prevalent when I started. So I started jumping in 2010, and I did it, like, I ground crewed for people. And, you know, living in Hawaii, we were doing a lot of buildings. And, you know, I was the driver, or I was the guy that carried things out of buildings that you maybe shouldn't have in order to get in buildings or whatever. Might have to delete that. I didn't have a comprehensive school. Like, I learned how to jump objects, but I also learned how to analyze objects and then apply certain principles to other objects. But I also didn't go to anything for the first time without somebody that had been there before. And so there was a, you know, it's a very personal experience, but I think these days, because I've had people reach out to me about, you know, like, I want you to teach me to bass. And I've taught like 5 people how to bass jump, and 4 of them are still alive. So maybe you don't want to come to me. But wait, what my buddy did, that wasn't what I taught. I didn't teach him that shit. But again, layers and variables. Now, like, I steer people toward taking a course, and I'm not overly, like, I don't endorse anyone over another one. Like, most of them are really good. But I'm like, no, I want you to go spend some time with Dukes or whoever. And then when you come out of that, then I know what I'm working with, because I know what your baseline is. And then I'd be happy to show you around Lauterbrunn and take you to, like, Lemus and some other places. You know, you're going to get some of those jumps in his course anyways. But you know what I mean? Like, it's one of those, now that there is so much more information than there used to be. And like, I would watch bass fail videos and skydiving fail videos when I was first getting into it, just to make sure it's something I wanted to do. I was like, I had to be ready to be prepared for the worst. Mm-hmm. But now there's just so many better options out there.
And you can do both. It used to be you find a bass mentor. First jump courses are now more popular, but I did both.
Yeah.
I had a couple mentors. I did a course after I had three bass jumps, and then took a course. And but I had a few mentors. I still have mentors, you know. I still look up to people. I still learn from them as much as I can.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's an evolving sport, and you've never learned everything, you know. So it's always good to jump with people that you look up to and respect. And then there's also a time at, you know, and for all of us it's different, but there's also a time to give back, you know. I remember, like, Rami, I had no clue who Rami was in the bass community, and I bumped into a couple of guys he was with, and he was taking them to, like, Lemus or Yellow, and he's like, yeah, come on along, you know, and brought me along. And then I was like, yeah, I'll be back next week. And he's like, cool. And, like, over the course of about 6 weeks, he took me to every exit in the valley and made sure I knew how to jump it correctly. Literally from Lemus and Yellow Ocean all the way around Nose 3, High Nose, Dumpster, and then we finished at the ramp. That was sort of like, I didn't know it, but that was like when he took me to the ramp, that was like kind of like the graduating jump or whatever. And but then you fast forward a couple of years, and I was in Arizona for the Bass Boogie in 2014, and Rami was there, and I was like, hey, dude, I know what you did, you know, like, you definitely, like, took me under your wing and helped me out, and now I try and, you know, when I get the opportunity, I try and pay that forward. So there will come a time when you may not be the new jumper, and you may need to, like, go do a jump that you weren't planning to do because somebody just needed that little bit of guidance, you know, and so you end up doing, like, a Lemus instead of, you know, going to Boos Alp or going up to, like, you know, Meiringen or somewhere where maybe you thought you were going to go, but situation changed, you know. But
yeah, one thing I love about bass jumping is the community, the sense of community, and people are just, generally speaking, so open and willing to help, whether it's sharing knowledge or show you exit points. And yeah, it's like special people in this community. It's amazing. And now living in Lauterbrunn, in one of the, you know, the mecca of bass, I've been here for 2 years now. It's like, and I had all my friends back from the U.S. When they come to visit. And yeah, it's just, it's so cool to be connected to this community.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. It's a very special place, you know, and I feel like there are other places, like, you know, you take Moab as an example, Twin Falls, you know, the Brento community, Norway, like, there are other spots out there that are similar, and they have, thankfully, they have for lack of a better term, like guardians that are gonna like do the right thing and help out where it's needed. And yeah, it's a beautiful sport, beautiful community. It's not without that dark side, though. You know, I don't want to get too sad on here, but you know, you live. It's a beautiful life, but it also there's a heavy toll. You know, when variables get layered and things go wrong.
I think a lot of time when things goes wrong is also because the sport should be, for me, treated as flying a plane. We should all think as pilots and try to like to copy them in terms of safety and the way of thinking, and not just going there without checking weather, for example, and thinking, oh, it'll be okay because it's just a little jump. It's just it's a base canopy. It can fly in not so great condition. And I think this is kind of the mindset that usually puts people into danger quite often without them knowing it. And then the one day a few things go wrong at the same time, then that day it's unfortunately usually over for that person.
Yeah, when I think about like when I started skydiving in 2002 and like back then you didn't really talk about base. Like it was almost like a closed club, and like you had to kind of like prove yourself as a skydiver before you could even like show interest in base jumping. And it's like all the base jumpers are like old fat like riggers usually, you know.
Yeah,
like
yeah, the old school guys.
Yeah. And like
some drop zones are still that way.
Yeah, but now it's like I feel like the sport has evolved. Like we're like some of us are actual athletes now, you know, and like and it pays to be in shape for a lot of reasons, because it's easier to get to the exits, you know, because you don't want to be like cramping, you know, at in flight. And you also like the better shape you're in, the better odds you have of surviving a traumatic accident, you know. So it's nice to have seen the sport evolve, you know, away from that like closed community. But I also thank the internet and you know, other, you know, social media for some of that evolution, because there's just more available now, you know.
Yeah, it used to be kind of like you had to kind of like be welcome to the secret club, you know. Mm-hmm. And some cities like around the states and stuff, some are very open, some are still kind of like sequestered and secretive and stuff.
Yeah, well, and some of that is especially like in America, because a lot of the spots to jump aren't legal, so yeah. So you do have to kind of like protect it and not just let, you know, anybody come burn your shit, you know. But
right.
So I kind of get it on some levels, but then yeah, but you can almost see like generational differences, you know, because like there was like the pre-YouTube generation that was very, very close hold on a lot of things and protective, and then the YouTube generation came along, and now we've got like Instagram and TikTok and all that other shit. So it's one of those it's not all good, it's not all bad, you know. It's just it's yeah. But it's evolving. Yeah,
yeah, it is what it is. I mean, each of us, like, we should be discerning in whom we choose to jump with. I know, like, without vetting somebody, I definitely don't necessarily feel comfortable jumping with someone unless I have learned that they tend to be, like, thorough, analytical, safe, fish, whatever, and or just knowledge. Like, I mean, yeah, being in this sport, I have friends who run the gamut from, like, the crazy to, you know, this and that, and to like the closet base jumper whom you'd never guess is a base jumper, but he's actually been jumping for 25 years, you know. Mm-hmm. And yeah, but just another aspect of base that I love so much is it's actually quite a diverse community in this sport, which the outside world tends to just write us off as all adrenaline junkies, but really in my experience, the majority of jumpers are, they're not looking for the adrenaline. Like, the adrenaline is the uncomfortable part that makes me shake, makes my stomach turn, makes my mouth dry. I'm looking for the sense of achievement, sort of like working through that and meditating almost. And but yeah, jumpers come in all types, and it's such a cool community because of that.
Yeah, I love finding that flow state, you know, like where it's just, you're just in that moment and like everything is just working, and but you're not even really thinking about it. It's just sort of, you're just doing it. Like that's sort of what drives me, and I kind of like the science of it. It's like, it's you know, packing is a relatively precise process, you know, like the technique of flying, whether it's tracking or, you know, wingsuiting, you know, it's like there's a science to it, so to speak. And we also have like I call them the data nerds, because now you know, like with the fly sites and whatnot, yeah. and being able to analyze data, just having that math to know like how you're performing, and it's almost irrefutable, really. I mean, if you jump the same spot over and over and over, and then you try and pull around the same height, like you can see like things that are like how you're improving, you know. But it takes like a consistent process to do that, and it's
yeah. There are a lot of nerds in this sport. I'm one of them. I tend to be very analytical, and I absolutely love that aspect too of base, like aerodynamics, fluid dynamics, learning the lift equation, you know, learning how speed correlates with lift and what that means if you're flying terrain and all that stuff. Yeah, we've been fortunate in the last few years to have some really intelligent people contribute to our knowledge of everything base, especially in wingsuit flying and stuff.
Yeah, even reading weather, you know, that's another thing.
Yeah, weather as well.
Love to give the paragliders props for that, because they understand weather better than anybody.
Yeah, always ask a paraglider.
Right? that's been my technique for years. It's like, I don't know, I'm not sure, but if I'm not sure, I'll talk to a paraglider. But if I'm not sure, I'm probably not going to go in the first place. But sometimes I'm completely off, and they can, you know, they can help me out. But
yeah, I know it's a...
We got Thunders over here.
Yeah.
Trying to get on the podcast.
Around.
Yeah.
Yeah, Thunder. Well, actually, I think a lot of people in the community know Thunder now.
Yeah.
We've been together for 13 years, and he's, you know, my best friend.
Yeah.
He's been to 30 countries with me.
Wow. Yeah, there's quite a few, I'd call them, popular base dogs out there.
Yeah, yeah. I remember when Dean jumped with Whisper.
Mm-hmm.
From the Mushroom, I think, right?
Yeah.
Wingsuited with her, or with her, him, can't remember. I think remember. I met the dog once in Moab, maybe. But anyway, yeah, and that's like the ingenuity that goes into base, people approaching it with these minds that want to like think outside the box, think what could be possible. From whether it's like rigging or just what kinds of jumps are possible. When people were first starting to drop from paragliders or like trikes, stuff like that. Yeah, Mr. Bill.
Oh, yeah.
Just like all kinds of, yeah, it's funny because I think it's like we never grew up. And I love that. Like we approach in this sport, we tend to approach it like a kid approaches the fun of things, like the adventure in something. And you're like, what if we like did a double gainer flip with holding hands and then high five while we're upside down, you know, like, and of course that does have to be balanced with the,
maybe don't do that with the unicorn mount, but
maybe nix the unicorn mount on that one. But yeah, it has to be kind of balanced with, I hate to say it, but sort of like the adult mind as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something beautiful about like how a child can be so excited about something as simple as monkey bars or blowing bubbles or whatever. Like trying to get, I don't think I can ever get that level of joy back, but I feel like bass does help us sort of get closer to that in a lot of ways.
Yeah, living here in Lauterbrunnen, I mentioned I've been here for 2 years, so I see a lot of friends come past for on their bass trips, old friends, new friends. I'm constantly meeting new people in the sport, and yeah, it's really like this like time capsule almost, where we're still just a bunch of kids who never grew up who are just having the time of our lives right now and really relishing that moment, which if you ask me, in a certain way, it's a form of wisdom in itself. It's like kind of figuring out your priorities enough to have the foresight to say, yeah, all this goes away someday. Let's enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I, you know, from my from like 2010 to about, I guess, when I broke my leg in 2018, I was so singularly focused on base jumping. The only fun travel I did was to go find something to jump off of. It took breaking my leg and then COVID to sort of help me broaden the aperture on my on life, you know. And so I have made some friends that don't jump, you know. And occasionally I travel without a rig, you know, to go just experience a new city. But yeah, I still bring some of that same. I try and apply that same love, you know, to these other things.
I've actually been thinking a lot of, along those lines lately. I don't base jump as often as I used to, not by any means. And I've been thinking a lot about what base means to me. Because there's a difference between like base as a community, as like a sport and stuff, and each individual jump sort of. And when I started base, I was chasing a dream that I've had since I was a kid. Like, I started skydiving in order to base jump in wingsuit, which I know all of us have our own paths, how we got here. Sometimes people just kind of evolve into base, but and other times, like in my circumstance, I think I saw a video back in the 90s on TV of a base jumper. I looked at it. I was probably like 8 years old, and I was like, that's what I do. You know, I just had this notion that, like, that's what I do. And then when wingsuiting became a thing, I was like, oh, yeah, that's what I do. Of course, I hadn't even skydived yet. But, it was cost prohibitive at first, but I was living in Colombia in South America at the time. I was a bit heartbroken, and it was way cheaper to do my AFF down there, so I did it in Spanish, which was a good test, you know. I started, and I finally had my skydiving license and just went full force into base or working toward base to like chase this dream of flying. So at that time in my life, base was important in that way. And here I am about 6 years later, and base, just the jumps themselves, I mean, they don't hold that same importance for me anymore, at least not at this time. It could have something to do with it being a rough summer. I lost a handful of close friends, and at least two of them were very close. But I actually feel like I was kind of leaning this way anyway for a while. And I'm in a different place in my life now than I was 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago. I used to live for base. I worked in the in Sequoia National Park, and I'd go to Yosemite every weekend and stuff. Everywhere I went was for base. But here now I am kind of settled, married, happy, content, and there are other things in life to enjoy, you know. It's not to say that base filled some hole or anything like that, because there was always this pure enjoyment in the jumps themselves, or the search for a jump, you know. Mm-hmm. You're driving around and you're always looking up and
all the time.
There's a crane, you know, like antenna. But yeah, where I'm at right now, mentally, physically, situationally, I've taken a bit of a break from base jumping for the last month. I'm not done by any means, but I'm content to not be constantly on the hunt for a new jump.
Mm-hmm. That's something that definitely feels good, I think, to sometimes take a little break from it. You do enjoy it more when you get back, I think. I quite like that, and try to do different activities during that time. Sometimes related, like paragliding. Related to flying. I think it's nice, as you say, not to try to be doing as many jumps as possible all the time.
Yeah, I'm definitely in a quality over quantity phase in my career at this point, if you can call it that. But it's one of those things where I'll be hanging out with friends and they'll be like, oh, you remember this one jump? And I'm like, no, I did 200 base jumps that year. I have a hard time, and I don't log. Also recommend keeping a log because your memory will fail you eventually. Yeah, I'm definitely in a quality over quantity phase, but it's important, I guess, depending on your goals. If you want to get to wingsuit base jumping, you need to be consistent in a lot of things, and you need to put the work in order to get there and then maintain it. And that was something I came to terms with when I broke my ankle. It was like, I don't know if I have the energy to get back to that place, like, because that took a lot of dedication, a lot of time. And I still fucked it up. So it's one of those things that. And so yeah. Now, but
currency is real. It's mm-hmm. it is important. Like, I can feel it when I go back and I'm not as current as I used to be. Like, there's a difference. And of course, like you were saying, Cyril, when you consider these added variables, you give yourself extra margin, and until you're current again. And but yeah, currency, it's a real thing, you know. It's important too, so.
Yeah, it's something that I discovered with COVID, so I wasn't able to jump for a little while. And when I went back to it, in my mind, I was still as good as I was 2 years ago. But I actually took quite a lot of jumps to get back to that feeling and to just to be comfortable on the exit, to do like the nice fast exit that I used to be doing, and so on. And that's something I wasn't I didn't think it was going to happen like this, because in my mind I was still the same. But now I realized, okay, for wingsuiting you definitely need to be more current. As you said, and always try to be on top of it. You can't just take a long break and thinking you'll just get back to wingsuiting as easy as it is, you know. The COVID, I think for a lot of people, when we went back to jumping, we did. We had a few close calls with my friends, things that never happened to us before that, and it was. That's when I decided to back off a little bit and to try to get back to the basics, go back skydiving, go do a little bit of tunnel flying, and do more easier jumps and more practice jump before going back into like big hikes and those really nice flight with really nice lines. More just focusing on practicing.
Yeah.
Yeah. COVID really like threw a wrench into things, specifically like within the community of base jumping and stuff. Yeah, it was a crazy thing because a lot of people pretty much stopped jumping for at least several months. Many people couldn't come over to Europe, for example, to train for like 2 years even.
Yeah. I couldn't cross the border into Switzerland from Germany.
Like, yeah.
It was close.
Yeah, and then, yeah, finally the borders opened up again. And I think we did see an uptick in injuries and I'm sure also fatalities. Things opened up. And like you were saying, Cyril, it's like in your mind, you're still the same jumper that you were a year ago or whatever, like when you were in your prime. But if you're not current, it's like, yeah, you got to kind of take that into consideration, back off a bit.
Yeah, well, I appreciated that a lot of the Swiss jumpers took a break, large because, you know, at the time we didn't understand how this plague was going to play out. And those hospital beds, you know, should have been reserved, you know, for people dealing with COVID and or other just, you know, getting old life injuries. But because base jumping is absolutely a choice. Yeah. And it's a selfish choice oftentimes, frankly, but then to risk taking a bed that could go to somebody else, you know, in a hospital, that didn't get COVID by choice, you know, so it's one of those things that I really, sort of respected a lot of the people that were living here that were choosing not to jump because of you know, the pandemic and, yeah, thinking about something just bigger than yourself.
Right. Yeah, you, Randy, you said just now base jumping is a choice and it's a selfish choice. And this is a question that I've asked myself a lot. It's like, is base jumping selfish? And my answer to myself is, well, yes, it's inevitably a selfish pursuit. But along those lines, what isn't? Like, and yeah, there's kind of like a difference. You could be, sometimes it's okay to have a selfish pursuit, and you take every action you can to mitigate risk, so that hopefully you never have to burden your family and friends with bad news or bad injuries. But then again, we also have to live and enjoy that life while we're here. So, yeah, it's like that's the second question is the first is it selfish? My answer is, well, yes, it's inevitably selfish. But the second is it wrong to be selfish? And the answer to that is like, it depends.
Yeah. But, yeah. And, you know, so a lot of people would have to take a negative term to the phrase selfish because, you know, it's like, oh, you're thinking about yourself first. However, if that's what you truly love and that's what makes you the best person you are, then you absolutely should do it because then you're going to benefit the people around you by doing what you love, you know, with part of your time. You know, so I do, I have like before I go to work and give 8 to 10 hours a day to a bunch of other people that need my, you know, my knowledge or my, input on things. I spend an hour and a half, 2 hours in the morning, like doing yoga, doing my little meditation, my little workout, a very robust morning routine but I pay myself before I go into the office, you know, and do stuff for other people so that I'm the best person I can be for them, you know, and I think base is similar in that regard, you know, that yeah, it's selfish, but it's also, it's you giving yourself that joy so that you can also go give other people a piece of you, you know?
Yeah, there's an aspect of it that's like, it's also self-care. And you could apply that to anybody pursuing whatever their passion or dream is. In a sense, that's self-care. And we all have to take care of ourselves mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually, whatever your jam is.
In my opinion, if you do, for base jumping, if you do everything you can to be as safe as possible, if you're not taking that extra risk for no reason, I don't think you can really call it selfish in that way, as this is something that defines you. I think it's the same for all of us base jumpers, that this sport is something that we can't really live without.
Sure.
But yeah, if you do it, if you're going to be the guy who is not going to give a shit about pretty much about his life and doing pushing all the time, flying always super, super close to the ground, really taking a lot of risk. Mm-hmm. I think this is selfish for your family and friends. But if you're always trying to be safe, have fun, but be as safe as possible. Of course, something bad can happen. I think it's the same with all mountain sports and a lot of other sports as well. But this is the way I see it. And I believe it's all about, how you behave.
Yeah, so maybe the bad selfish side of base is when you disregard clear indications that you shouldn't jump, or you break the rules in Lauterbrunnen because, you know, you're only here for 2 weeks and you're like, screw the time limits on, jumping times for certain objects. So that maybe that's sort of the bad side of the self, like when it can be a negative selfish side of the sport or behavior, rather.
Yeah, Cyril, you mentioned something that I'd be curious to hear your opinions on it. I often think about when you were talking about jumping well within your means. I generally tend to jump most of my jumps within just a qualitative subjective estimate. Like I try to jump around maybe 60% of my ability on most jumps, and then every now and then I'll push it a little, maybe closer to terrain or whatever the kind of jump is, up to 80, and then every now and then 90-95, but then I go back to jumping 60% of my ability. And I know many other jumpers, a lot of people I've been friends with, every single jump is 95% of their ability. Many of those guys are not with us anymore. Of course, base is a personal journey, and we are thankfully all free to make our own choices. But what do you guys think is, what kind of pattern do you guys have as far as how often do you push it to 90%+ of your ability on a jump? Because for me, it's maybe 1 in 30 jumps, something like that. And usually I stick around 60%, fly higher, fly a little higher, don't push it as much.
It's hard for me to give numbers. I definitely do kind of the same way. Most of the jumps are going to be training jumps, and maybe for a few days we'll be doing going to some special places, Dolomites, or even sometimes here Mechstuhl. And we know when we go to Mechstuhl, we're going to have some fun, So usually when I go to Mexico, I'm like, okay, I'm going for terrain flying. I'm not just going for a cruisy flight. But I don't go there every weekend. And it's hard to say how often. I'll be a little bit pushing and having fun, but it, as you said, it's always still try to keep some margins. Always thinking about if the conditions are not as I thought they were, I still need that little margin, extra margin to flare out and pull and have always thinking as well about a safe place to land, even if it's on the mountain. Within the flying the line, I will be like looking for those at the same time.
Yeah, so I'm not sure I could put numbers or percentages to it either, but what I usually do is if I'm going to a new spot, whoever's taking me there, I generally prefer that they've seen me jump some other stuff and seen sort of how I performed there, and then I pick their brain a lot. We watch a lot of footage before we go to the new spot, so I have a pretty good idea in my head of what's going on. But then, yeah, I always can use like Sputnik for example. I don't know, I've probably jumped there 30, 40 times. I don't know. Like again, I don't log, so who knows? My numbers could be skewed. But I've never gone down into the trench. And I've been there on a couple of different wingsuits, but like
the crack.
Yeah, yeah. Down in. Sorry, yeah. That's about. But I've never gone down in inside. You know, like, but it's like I get a little bit closer, but not like. I don't know. I don't like terrain flight like that. Like, because Dan Vickery was one of the first wingsuiters to die that was really close to me, and I looked at what they were doing because they were on that leading edge of proximity flying at the time, and I put that in my head as like, well, proxy flying is a great way to die, and so I just never really got into that. So I would think I was usually operating in like probably a 60-70% if I had to put a number on it, that I was rarely found myself in a undesirable situation in flight. Most of my accidents usually happen after the parachute opened, and then I screwed myself because I either opened over a bad terrain, or I, instead of addressing the heading that my parachute was going, I addressed the twists first. Things like that.
Right.
Yeah. So it was never. It was always absolutely my fault. I don't blame the equipment. And but yeah, it's usually the what happened under canopy as opposed to what happened during the flight.
Yeah. I think it's important to just so nobody gets the wrong idea. Like what I'm talking about is just my own personal journey through base. Like, I'm definitely not saying that's the correct way or anything, and there's nothing wrong with somebody who chooses to make every jump like at the maximum of their ability and stuff. I mean, that's one thing that I love about base is it's a free world. It's unregulated. It's at the end of the day, nobody will look out for you but you. So it's up to you to educate yourself, to train, understand your limits and things like that. So I'm definitely not saying that it's wrong, of course, for somebody to jump at their ability. And in fact, you could make an argument that says, like, often we progress faster when we push our limits, not just in base, but just in anything. Often we have to step outside of our comfort zone in order to progress. So there's also something to be said about that. In flying closer to your limits, maybe you grow more as a flyer. You learn more. Maybe you learn faster. Yeah, that's the delicate balance of base that we're all trying to stay on the safe side of.
Sure. Yeah, it's an incremental sort of progression, I totally see what you're saying. Like, yeah, it's you. you have to get out of your comfort zone in order to do new things, you know, but knowing when you're ready, you know, for that is you know, like you said, it's a personal decision. But yeah, you never, you know, you're only going to jump off a cliff one time for the first time, you know, with a wingsuit. You know, there's always going to be that first thing. And then, you know, then you're going to add to that and continue adding. So yeah, I mean, that's progression, you know. But, yeah, I totally see what you're saying.
Nothing like that first jump, though.
I didn't screw up too bad, but, yeah, I definitely, there were a couple of wingsuits in my early days that I did not take skydiving. And, yeah. You know, I'm at Brento, like, and in my head, I'm like, well, you already know what this fatality report's going to say. You already know. Yeah. And then I did it anyways, you know, and it was fine, you know, but, I don't entirely regret that decision. So, is what it is. But, yeah.
Did you do a lot of slider off stuff in the States?
Yeah, like I was, I was at about, and this was back when I still had a logbook, I was at about 75 jumps-ish, almost all in America. I count Hawaii as America. Some people don't. But all slider down with like maybe a few slider ups at Bridge Day. And I was pulling crazy high and sniveling at Bridge Day. But so almost all of my experience was slider down in the early days. And other than Twin Falls, all of those jumps were not permissible. So usually at night. And so then when I came to Lauterbrunnen, was like, oh, wait, you can do this in the daytime? Yeah.
You're not, like, running behind the closest tree and, like, stashing your bag and throwing it in a locker and trying to remember what number locker you put
right?
in.
Right. Some of those first jumps here, I was packing everything up real fast. I'm like, whoa, pump the brakes. Slow down. You can just put your toggles back like a gentleman and make sure everything's lined up straight and then put it away.
Just don't land in the tall grass, or you'll have some angry Swiss farmer yelling at you in Swiss German.
Yeah, always land next to the flag or in vicinity of the flag, and you'll be fine. And don't spend too much time on the grass, even then. But yeah, that was a game changer for me. The other one was jumping in Istanbul in 14. That was my first permissible building. In the daytime.
Oh, was that the showdown, competition
thing
Istanbul
that they
had?
Yeah, Showdown or something like that. A Pro Base World Cup, I think we ran it. But yeah, it was, you know, I'm standing on top of this building, like just looking down. I see traffic. I see all sorts of, you know, I'm just like, ugh, this is, it gave me a lot of anxiety. Because when you jump off buildings at night, not a lot of traffic, not a lot of pedestrians. You know, a lot of things, but you also can't see things like power lines. So
better look at the landing area first.
Oh,
usually.
Always go by the landing area in the daytime.
It's an eerie feeling jumping buildings at night, like 4 a.m. and the whole city's sleeping, but you're floating above it under parachute. It's a pretty cool thing, huh?
Yeah, that was my introduction. Like I did 16 jumps in Twin. And then, I feel like with base, you jump what you got, you know. And in Hawaii, we had a couple of little cliffs over on Kauai, and then we had a lot of buildings on Oahu. And that's what I did a lot of. And I would take every time I could take some vacation or, you know, one of those four-day, like, holidays, we'd fly out to Twin Falls, you know, add a couple of days of vacation on top of the four-day holiday, and then, like, and then crank out a bunch of jumps at the bridge. But yeah, it's a lot easier to jump now. that was part of that whole, like, I changed my entire adult life to be kind of close to Lauterbrunn.
I think I must be one of the luckiest guys to be able to move here. I came here on a base trip and saw this beautiful girl. I was immediately smitten and fell in love. And for some reason, she liked me back. And Now I live here. It's amazing.
You're a pretty likable guy.
Well, thank you, Randy.
Do either of you guys want one of these last beers? I got six. So if everyone, but.
Well, if you got six, serve them up.
I had six, but we've already drank four of them. So I'm not going to fight you guys for these last two.
I'm not going to steal your last beer.
Oh, no. I mean, it was...
Go for it, Randy.
Okay, well, I'll drink one of them. One of you guys wants the other one. But, yeah, we're... Yeah.
So what are your plans for your biz career now?
Dude, I'm searching. I'm trying to figure it out. You know, I didn't have a clear set of goals with bass when I started base jumping. Fun fact, my mom grew up about 20 minutes away from Fayetteville, West Virginia. So as a kid, like, I had been to Bridge Day and I saw base jumping. Like,
oh, nice.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember when I went to Bridge Day the first time, I was like, I've driven across this bridge before as a kid. Yeah, my grandma also lived near Fayetteville.
Nice. Yeah, my mom's from Beckley. But I didn't have a clear path. Like, I didn't even know you could be a skydiver per se. Like, I was at a party after, like, my freshman year of college. I was back home, and this dude was talking about being a skydiver, and he was bragging to these girls, and I was all like, oh, when are you going again? And he's like, tomorrow. And I'm like, cool, I'm going with you. And, like, I did a tandem, had a blast, and I called my dad, and I was like, Dad, I just jumped out of a plane, and I want to do it again. Like, give me some money. I'll pay you back, I promise. So yeah, he paid for my second skydive over the phone, and they were like, hey, you seem to really enjoy this. Like, we're going to show you some stuff. It was, like, basically some pre-AFF stuff. I was kind of like, I just wanted to go on the ride again, but wait, you can just do this? Like, it just didn't, it wasn't, I didn't grasp it. So then all of a sudden, like, you know, they enrolled me in their program, didn't have enough money to finish that summer. But when I got back to school in the fall, I joined the skydiving club, and we did static line progression. So none of the jumps I did that summer really counted toward anything other than just experience. It was just baby steps and just sort of figuring it out. I mean, because a poor college student, like, I spent all my money on either beer or skydiving, I only had like 150 skydives by the end of my college career, and then, you know, joined the Marine Corps, and so I kind of took a break from from skydiving while I was active duty. And then toward the end of my active duty obligation, I started jumping again and started jumping in Hawaii. So I had a long hiatus, and now I'm in a very technical environment as far as, like, winds and things like that. So that helped me grow up real fast, because if you can skydive in Hawaii, like, you can basically jump anywhere. And those guys, you know, showed me a lot and took me under their wing. And after I did some jumps in Twin, like, they got me my first building, my first cliff, a lot of other buildings and cliffs. But I didn't have a very clear goal. I wanted to get a base number. I figured that's the next thing you do. You get all four objects, and the wingsuiting was really becoming pretty prominent. You know, YouTube was starting to be more of a thing. But I didn't have very clear goals. I was just sort of taking baby steps, and I kept taking baby steps, and then I found myself here in, you know, like, a Kalugo 2 or a Freak 2, and after that, I participated in a handful of competitions, did okay in a few of them, but then I was kind of searching, and then right around the time I got hurt, I think I was sort of at, like, the peak of my jumping career as far as, like, progressing, and now I'm in a place where I care more about the people and I care more about the places we go than I do the actual jumps. It's like, I was in Tallinn a few months ago, and I only did like four jumps. Like, I didn't go super hard, but I was mostly there because I knew I was going to see a bunch of cool friends, people I hadn't seen, you know, since before the plague. And so I was mostly there for the people and did a few jumps, felt good, kind of knocked the dust off a little bit.
But yeah, now I'm definitely kind of searching for what it's what I want to sort of put my energy into. But I know the people are still part of it. You know, it's one of those. But probably I'm coming to a place where I probably not going to wingsuit base anymore. At least not for a while. Like we'll see. I need to get back in the sky, and really and plus between, you know, the injury and then COVID, and a slow return, like the equipment has evolved, and I feel like it almost left me behind, and I'm kind of like not sure I want to put that energy into like figuring out new suits. I'm very interested in like the one piece track suits. Because just not having to unzip and just being able to like immediately fly your canopy and address any concerns, that entices me. So yeah, we'll see. Just sort of figuring it out.
I think you should definitely get a one piece tracksuit.
Yeah, we're about the same height. Maybe
yeah, you can try
and do some skydiving. Yeah.
Yeah. No, for sure. I think it's the biggest revolution in base jumping. It really brings maybe that extra margin, I'd say, in some way. Depend how you fly it. Mm-hmm. Depend what you want to do. But here for the Valley, it's really enjoyable. Yeah, maybe you can try mine.
Yeah, deal. Yeah, once we get past this winter season, I don't skydive in Germany or Switzerland in the winter. If we go anywhere, we'll go down to Spain or somewhere slightly warmer. And that could be on the books, maybe January-ish, February. We'll see.
Sweet.
We'll see. Yeah.
Mark nice. It on the calendar.
Yeah.
But, I've never jumped a one piece.
Yeah, me either.
No way.
Never.
No, I take that back. I've done a couple of skydives in like the original one. I don't even think it was a one. Was there a onesie and then the onesie power, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I had a few jumps out of one of the first onesie originals.
Which is really, really different from the onesie power.
It was a terrible experience. I did terrible. I felt like I was completely
out of control. The first one pieces, they were very difficult to fly. Mm-hmm. The newest models are very, very well balanced and, yeah, you have a lot of fun with them for sure.
Nice.
Yeah. It doesn't feel it really feels comfortable on the exit, standing on the exit with those suits. You know you have the power, and also the safety with the with reaching the risers straight away after opening. For sure, for me, my 1Z power, I have the original 1Z power. And it's still my favorite suit out of all.
Nice.
Even if mostly wingsuit, I still, if there was one suit that I had to choose and say this is going to be the only suit I'll be jumping forever, it would be the my 1Z power.
Nice. That's good to know.
I'll tell you what suit I wouldn't choose. Is my first trip to Brento, I made my own smoke pants. You know, in the classic tradition, like they used to do.
I'm so glad you didn't name a brand right there.
No, I know. like, let the brand wars begin. No.
Yeah, right.
No, I found these. They were like XXL rain pants for like $10 or something. And I just burned holes into them. And actually, I did sew mesh over them as well. So it was like a little bit fancy, but...
Nice.
But yeah, I had these huge rain pants. I experimented with running a bungee cable through the inside. Didn't seem to make any difference at all. It just made them loud because it flapped.
Mm, yeah.
But yeah, my first trip to Brento, I was tracking in smoke pants. But yeah, good times.
Nice. Yeah, speaking of good times, this has been a great time, guys. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to sit down. I feel like there's so much more to talk about, but I have a small bladder, and I think we also have a barbecue to get to. So I'd like an open invite anytime you want to do this again, you know, please. Because that part for me, part of the awkward part is being like, oh, do you want to be on my podcast? You know, like we get all like weird.
You want to come to my birthday?
Right. But yeah, so we covered some considerations on, you know, snag hazards, you know, how to, you know, maybe things to think about with wearing, you know, wearing cameras in certain places.
One quick note on snag hazards is, it's also important to, for newer jumpers, if you're listening, handheld is different than stowed. Like as far as wearing a GoPro on your helmet goes, I know a lot of guys don't jump. If they're going handheld, they don't jump with a GoPro on the helmet, maybe a chest mount or something. But there is an added consideration there, which I suppose is helpful to mention.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because if you're mostly upright and then you throw that pilot chute and the bridle out relatively in front of you, depending if there's wind or something, yeah, it could absolutely go across your face and then snag. Thanks for bringing that up. That's really important to think about. I've gone handheld so many times with a camera on my head.
I'll do it, but always with the awareness that it is a snag hazard and to be very conscious of it.
You know? And if you're going to go handheld, maybe let somebody PCA you if you don't want to wear that camera. You know, that just a thought. You know, each object's different. Like, so, I don't know. Nothing I say is like dogma. You know, it's not like, because each jump is different, and the intent of this podcast was just to get people thinking about what they do and what they're doing on that jump and how frequently they do those things and what other variables they're introducing simultaneously. Yeah, so hopefully we achieve that. I guess sort of the beauty of this is we'll never really know, but maybe somebody out there will hear it and do something slightly different, and then they'll have a great day, you know. And that's all we can hope for. You guys want to care to share where people can find you on social media or any of that stuff?
But I mean, I have like 500 followers, so like, not like I'm getting any sponsorships.
Right.
My name's Devin Kelly, Devin Mudcat Kelly on Facebook. I kind of took over my dog's Instagram, so it's Thunder Wonder Dog on Instagram. The only one that I just mentioned that on the side, but I did start a business here called Dog Pack, making gear for dogs, like harnesses and backpacks, like ultralight backpacks and stuff. So I'm here with Thunder. He's got his latest prototype on. If you're interested, it's at the Dog Pack. Dog Pack is DOGPAK.
Nice. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Like, I plan to talk a little bit more about that, and I also wanted to visit, which I think we'll have to do at a later date, but I wanted to talk a little bit about your, I don't even know what to call it. Brian told me you were like a ranchero or something down in like...
Yeah, I'm a cowboy.
Yeah.
But actually a cowboy.
Yeah, maybe next time we'll do maybe a little bit of a more of a Joe Rogan style podcast where we're just bullshitting and like, because I want to hear these stories. I think that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, I have one or two for you.
Nice. What about you, Cyril?
I don't care.
Cyril doesn't give a shit. Yeah, that's cool.
Cyril's a vet, and actually, he's too modest to say, but he runs the most successful vet clinic in Lausanne, right?
Yeah, it is the best rated on Google, which is, as I was saying before, it's a good thing for the business, but not a good thing for base jumping as I'm very busy working.
Yeah, he helped Thunder when Thunder had torn his ACL or CCL in dogs in his knee. So, yeah, thank you, Cyril.
I don't think I helped that much that night. I was a little bit drunk. Diagnosis was not on point. But
it was actually, when you looked, it was only partially torn, so all good.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, guys, thank you again for taking the time to be on the show, and I really appreciate you helping me get you know, knock the dust off and just get back in the rhythm of trying to do this. So, and I'm sure the community will.
Thank you for your help for the community with the podcast.
Yeah, it's fun.
It's well appreciated. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for the invite, Randy.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll do it again. In fact, we may have a semi-permanent set up here. So then, like, whenever I'm back, you know, I'll just make a point to, like, try and sit down with some people. And cool. Yeah, because I prefer the in-person thing. I've done a couple of, like, you know, WebEx-type conversations, but when I can't read someone's body language very well, like, I feel like I'm missing some of that human connection. And so, like, now that we're travel's basically back to normal, like, I feel like this can be a more of a regular thing. And I think that just sort of the, you know, the good feels I got from doing this is going to give me the motivation to do more of them, you know? So, yeah. Thank you, guys. So,
sweet. Well,
that being said, this has been a Base Life podcast. We're out.